Hi, and welcome to the MVR podcast, number 14. I'm Rachel Elmer.
And I'm Peter Jacob.
And today we're talking about practitioners embodying MVR. So as always, Peter, how did we get to this subject today?
Well, I can't remember exactly how we got to it. I think we were talking about training and some of the challenges that we face as NVR trainers, training other practitioners. And what seemed to come up was that it's not just what practitioners do, what they communicate to their clients when they're working within an NVR framework. It is how they do it. And that is probably the most important factor in building a real working alliance with their clients.
Yeah.
And encouraging their clients to do what you have to do in NVR, which is to go out of your comfort zone. So the clients need a lot of containment, I think, by the professional. And that containment probably is built on the professional embodying NVR. I think that's kind of how we got to this topic. But
yeah.
I'm curious about something because earlier you were talking about a supervision session you had with a colleague.
Mm-hmm.
And you were sharing that this colleague came to the supervision session without any sort of clear question or without any problem in their client work. Probably were all going rather well. So you simply brought up, if I remember you correctly, you brought up the question of presence.
Practitioner presence.
And presence, of course, is the cornerstone, or more than the cornerstone of NVR. It's the foundation of NVR. It's what everything is built on. So I was just wondering about that conversation, whether you might want to share some of that.
Yeah, I've worked with this colleague for many years, and she runs groups, parent groups, and so yesterday's in supervision she had a couple of little questions but nothing burning, and I thought and recently I've been doing a lot of training online and thinking about my trainer presence, how difficult and challenging this new way of working is. And so I thought it would be really nice opportunity to spend some time speaking with this colleague about her practitioner presence, how she viewed herself in her group work online, delivering to parents, how she thought the parents were receiving her as well, where her strengths were, what she was enjoying most about the group, what parallel processes were taking place in that group environment, in that group delivery. When we think about embodying presence, silence, communication, persistence, you know, we think about all of those kind of principles. I was just asking her lots of questions, really, about her practice and her delivery.
And what did she feel about her presence? Did she feel that going online, delivering the parent group work online, makes it more of a struggle to be present, powerfully present? That would be one question that comes to my mind.
I think she really related to the difficulties that we're all facing using these new platforms such as Zoom and Teams and Google Meets, and that there's a risk, I think, of of losing a sense of ourselves. You know, when we think about that, the three elements of presence, the sort of the physical, I'm here in the room, you can see me, that embodied presence, about that persistence and how we communicate ourselves, our message, our ethos around working using this approach, and then that sort of systemic presence. Mm-hmm. So how she's incorporating her co-facilitator within the group, parent group work. I think it's an ongoing challenge. And what this colleague expressed was that she felt there's a risk of not always wanting to introduce some of the things that she would be doing in a face-to-face environment, because of the uncertainty of how it might fit, how it might be received. So, for example, a silence exercise where we encourage parents to practice and utilize communicating some of their distress through silence, through being present and grounding themselves. And and so my colleague had kind of recognized that was an element that she perhaps was more reluctant to incorporate online for the uncertainty of how it would be received. So we really sat and unpicked how it would look and how might she develop a stronger sense of herself and confidence in enabling parents to practice this using this platform.
So there seems to have been something at play there, which I call pre-censorship.
Uh-huh.
So something, I'm the practitioner, something emerges, comes to mind. It just comes up in my mind. And with it, that sense, oh, this could be really helpful. Yeah. Perhaps connected with my experience. And then it's like there's a different voice, you know, that says, oh, but this is a different platform and it may not be received so well. And, you know, you sort of get discouraged. And then perhaps you don't even put it forward anymore. You know, that in a way that also seems to be a parallel process to what parents often experience, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How do you experience that as a parallel process?
Oh, absolutely. I have my client load and I work directly with parents, and there's that, you know, I've tried that once and didn't quite get the outcome I anticipated. I won't do that again. There's something about, you know, the key thing in MVR is about persistence and having to grow that deeper sense of your determination, your commitment, having to play with something and see how it fits within you. We have to do it more than once.
I was just thinking of something that Dan Dahlberger shares very often. He's done that in writing and also in conversations and in training. He talks about a session that he had with some parents, and he brought up an idea and wanted to discuss whether this could be a possibility. I can't even remember what it was. And the mother looked at him angrily and said, "You don't know what you're talking about." And Dan said, "I beg your pardon." You know, it was quite rude. And then the mother said, "No, no, no, that's what she would say."
The dog. Okay.
And Dan experienced this as a situation in which the parents had no presence or very little presence in the room. They did not allow themselves to imagine that they would do whatever it was that he was bringing up as a possibility. They didn't even play with that possibility in their minds, because the voice was the voice of the daughter who was not physically present in the room. Her voice filled the room. And I wonder whether that can happen to the practitioner working with the parents, that the practitioner has that same pre-censorship that these parents demonstrated, that the practitioner thinks about what the parents would say and therefore maybe doesn't even go further in her own mind to explore how she might communicate with the parents.
Yeah, that's such a common theme, what I see time and time again in training environments where we are delivering the, for example, the foundation training. And often when we invite the participants to feedback what they've heard, often that voice is, well, like, that won't work with the parent I'm working with. They wouldn't do that. They couldn't, you know, and again, it's the voice of the parent, not the practitioner. And equally, sometimes, you know, working directly with the parent, it's the voice of the child, not the actual parent. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. So that, you know, that puts, you know, from the perspective of a trainer, of course, our colleagues' cases are much more difficult than any of the cases we've ever worked with. I guess that is that when our colleagues' presence diminishes because of that pre-censorship, how do we encourage them to raise their presence? I guess one step is to ask them to suggest that they don't pre-censor in their thinking or in their communication with clients.
Yeah. I don't use the word pre-censor. I say that it's really common for practitioners to predict what the parents will say when we're coaching them through this process of MVR and how might it feel to invite a parent to think and consider and role play, good old fashioned role play it out. And I'm wondering whether it would change. Mm.
So instead of not bringing up an idea, a possibility, not inquiring it together with the client, they can switch from talking about to role play. Role play doing and experiencing. So you can bypass the negative predictions. The parents' negative predictions and the practitioner's negative predictions in themselves about the parents' negative predictions. The practitioners can bypass those by switching from talking about to moving into. I guess that's
moving into.
Mm. Yeah. Role playing is moving into, isn't it? It's already doing because you're already practicing a possibility.
Yeah.
When you're role-playing, aren't you? You're preparing yourself for the actual positive action that you may take. You're exploring, how does this feel? How do I experience this? What is the effect on me of doing this? So the practitioner opens space for the parent to do that. And by virtue of opening that space, rather than shutting down these thoughts in their own minds, the practitioner gets more presence.
Yeah.
At that moment.
Yeah. Mm.
I would have.
Go on. I was just going to say, I think the concept of presence is a very difficult concept to begin to enable parents to start to consider and think about, you know, just the concept about the physical presence is quite easy to get, isn't it? You're in the room, you know, you may be there in body, but not in mind, but you're in the room. So that's quite easy to kind of understand, but it's that embodied presence that I think can present a challenge for practitioners to communicate to families and for sometimes families to understand. You know, you're stuck a bit if you hate role play. I think I'm a hater of role play, but I do not like it.
Really?
Yeah, but I know that it's a necessity. I have to do it, and I know that families all feel very uncomfortable with doing this, particularly online. But it really does change the way we work by embodying that.
I guess I'm really lucky because I've got acting in my blood. My dad was an actor after the war, giving away my age. We're talking World War II. So I love to act. I love to role play.
Really?
But I was just thinking of something. I was just thinking of when I, the professional, come up with an idea, a possibility. What happens? What is the arc of my own emotions? You know, So I'm just thinking at some point when the idea comes up in my mind, it might feel, yep, you know, that, yep, this is it feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know whether there's a word that describes that feeling. And then I feel something like, oh dear. Yeah. The negative expectations start kicking in and I feel a kind of a sense of dread. The parents are going to hate this idea, or this is way out. They might think that I'm stupid and so forth. This is the moment in that arc where my presence is at risk of dropping off, right? Because I'm at risk of shutting down my own mind. But then I detect in myself something else, a sort of a sense of excitement. You know, I think I get more animated. And I think this is again where embodiment comes in. You know, that the way that I get more animated, if I don't allow the negative expectations to shut my mind down and to shut down what I'm actually doing, then I will communicate something to the clients just through my body language, just through the enthusiasm of my words, just by virtue of the way I look at my clients and talk to them. And then I start picking up the resonance. I start picking up how my clients respond in that moment. And I guess I need to be empathic to them. That's really important. I think that's also part of the embodiment in this process. I need to be empathic to how they are receiving what I'm communicating. And they might receive it in a variety of different ways. They might start getting excited. I experienced that in a session yesterday, where out of the three people I was talking to, two parents and a sibling, two of them got really excited, the dad and the sibling. And the mom wasn't excited. So the mum looked worried. And now in this arc, at this point, there's a risk, right? There are several risks, I guess. One risk is that in my enthusiasm, I go with the dad and the sibling and I override the mum, right? That's a risk. The other risk is I empathically hone in totally on the mum. And the barriers come up again in my mind. And I think, oh, no, can't do this. Yeah. In which case, I would not do justice to the dad and the sibling, but also I wouldn't do justice to myself. So I have to balance that in that moment. I have to create space for the excitement in the dad and in the sibling that I have inspired. And I have to create space for the concern, the worry, the negative beliefs about what an outcome could be like in the mum. So I have space for all those different responses. So I guess what happens at that point is I then, as the professional, I become quite calm and focused, but not, I don't sort of despair. You know what I mean? I don't shut down. I don't end up thinking, oh, this is impossible. This isn't going anywhere. Or thinking, oh, there's something wrong with this client because she doesn't get it. You know what I mean? Instead, I just get very focused. And I'm sort of in this sort of really focused work mode. And I explore. I give space for the dad and the sister's excitement. And I explore the mom's concerns. And then I engage with her in how do we deal with those concerns? You know, can the concerns, rather than leading to not doing anything, do they contain valuable information for shaping a plan? Are they concerns that on second thought, the mother will feel don't really matter so much, and so forth and so on. So there seems to be that arc that starts with an idea, the sense that the idea fits or might fit, you know, which is a good feeling. The discouragement that comes from the negative expectation, not yielding to the negative expectation, the excitement in myself when I let the idea expand in my mind and in my communication with clients, the resonance between me and my clients, the quite serious focus, and then moving towards an action plan that feels right for everyone in the room.
I bet you do all that in about 3 seconds, don't you?
No, not in 3 seconds. I guess if and when I can go through that whole arc, then my presence has been really very strong in the room.
Yeah. While you were talking, I was thinking about a couple of clients I've had over the years of some dads predominantly, that are sort of sheepish, not really wanting to role play, not seeing it as, you know, perhaps they've got very different occupations and it's very out of the blue. It feels a little bit, the term tree huggy, you know, really out of their comfort zone. And there's reluctance. And while you were talking, I was just making some notes. And thinking there's a drive that enables a parent to practice role play even when they hate it, even when they really don't want to do it. The drive is it's for their child. That's the drive, the common drive for everyone to do this, to stay focused, to practice, to learn these new skills and techniques. Is the common drive is the child. They do it because they want to improve things for their kid.
That is the motivation.
The motivation and the drive.
And that is why they stick out something. And I'm just thinking of what is it that they stick out and that we as the practitioners stick out with them. And the word that comes to my mind is the liminal space. You know, the space in between? Like you're on a threshold. A threshold, you know, some people will speak about coming outside of one's comfort zone, even in your mind. Yeah. Just in thinking, oh, I might do that. I might say to my daughter, I'm not going to wash your clothes. You can wash your clothes. You're old enough for that. For example. Yeah. Just one of hundreds or thousands of examples. And just imagining I might do that. I'm already crossing over onto the threshold. I'm in that liminal space between how it has been and how it may become as the parent. And I, as the practitioner, I go into that liminal space with the parent. And it's very easy to get disheartened as the practitioner or as the parent in that liminal space. So there's something about we raise our own presence as practitioners when we can stay in that liminal space and have a lot of contact with ourselves, with our ideas, with our, with our feelings, with our experience, with our empathy for the client. When we can do all those things, we can, I think we can stay in that liminal space. We can stay on that threshold with them.
And I just wrote down holding them in that space, and obviously not in a physical sense, but just that in that, very appropriately in that kind of sense of, you know, emotionally, mentally holding them through in that space, and that encouragement and that reinforced holding on to that hope that things will change. I think it's a really wonderful, privileged place to be for the family. Absolutely.
And it is very privileged that the family lets us do that with them and for them, that we provide that containing sort of role. And I think in NVR, it's essential.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm just thinking, should we sort of look at what we were talking about in a nutshell? Is there a way to draw some conclusions from what we were talking about?
Yeah, I think my conclusions, it's a big role being an NVR practitioner. There's so many layers to what we do. And I think we've just touched on the word, I think that strikes me most about this work is the privileged position that I find myself in of holding a family through this journey and being a part of that and witnessing the tears and the frustrations and the joys. And and I think there's something about embodying this practice in what I bring to a family, and hoping that they get a sense of that from me to carry forward. And
I think that in discovering this idea that a lot of the work, the practitioner's work, happens, if it's effective, in that liminal space, it's very important. And I think it's only one dimension of embodiment, of the practitioner's embodiment of NVR. I think we've only just started touching on this subject.
Well, I think we could talk about another hour.
I can think of 3-4 more dimensions that come to my mind.
Okay, don't say any more then. There'd be future
podcasts. Okay, we'll do those another time. There'll be topics for another podcast. Okay.
Well, as always, it's been a pleasure and a joy. I think that's been a really nice discussion today. Next podcast in a few weeks. So goodbye from me. Bye-bye.
And goodbye. And look forward to speaking with you again, Rachel.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.